He who thus considers things in their first growth and origin, whether a state or anything else, will obtain the clearest view of them. Aristotle. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week, both newcomers and returning listeners. March has been another fantastic month to start the year. We're getting averaging over, a large number of downloads so far this year. So I, again, appreciate everyone who has listened and downloaded, even if it is not weekly, even if it is sporadic. You know, I have a couple of people who tell me they, download a backlog of episodes, and they'll listen, and they'll wait a month or two, and they'll come back. And, of course, I have a number of people who download weekly, and however you listen to this show, again, I appreciate it. So, this week, we're going to be continuing our philosophical discussions about the origin of cities, but this week, we're going to be coming from a very classical perspective, moving into more practical or factual aspects of city developments, maybe towards the end of this episode, possibly next week. I'm not sure yet how that's going to go. We're going to see how far we get to this week. Before that, though, I did want to respond to a couple of questions and feedback from a couple of listeners. And first, it's in response to some of my critiques of Child's 10, I guess, 10 points of what makes a city. They pointed out fairly, I think, that Child was not saying that, a city had to have all these things, that these are more, I guess you would expect a city to have probably a majority of these things, and that, hunter-gatherer societies may have some of these points, but they're not going to have as many as a city. And I think that's a fair, response to my criticism. However, ultimately, I think the first point, population density and population amount, are really what separates a city from any other type of society. So, in my opinion, the primary factor for cities is that population density, is that population amount, primarily above anything else. And then you can debate further, comparatively to a society that is not centralized versus, a city that is. How many of those, a city is more likely to have those other points than a non-urban society is. And that's a fair criticism. However, I think, again, we come back to point number one being the primary determination of a city. And, the other points, they're just kind of not necessarily window dressing, but they're not coming about because of the city. At least the city's not the primary factor that these points arise. It's more of a factor of human development and society is my response. So, but again, that's just kind of a rough bit of feedback on my part. And I hope what we talk about the rest of this episode will kind of play into that thought of mine. And I'm going to try to make some more points on that when we get to the meat of this week's episode. However, there was another bit of feedback I had from one of my international listeners, and forgive me, I forgot to write down the name. But they were interested in the UN statistics I quoted. And they were curious what the U.S. criteria was for the foundation of, or establishment, or incorporation, whatever you want to call it, of a city in the United States, and where it fell on the UN's, data set. So, go ahead and answer that real quick, and then we'll dive into the meat of this episode. And essentially, the answer is that the U.S., the United States, does not have a process to establish a city. Or rather, it has one, but it can't be done more than once, or maybe one at a time, I guess. But to that end, I'll explain. The United States Constitution does not give the federal government explicit permission to create cities, with one exception. Congress was allowed to establish a district of no more than 10 square miles to house the government that they would have, ultimate authority over. If it was made from territory of an existing state, though, the Constitution didn't allow Congress to seize the land. It would have to be freely given or negotiated for with whatever state legislatures they were looking to take the land from. Now, this process was used to create Washington, D.C., with land from Virginia and Maryland. Now, of course, after the population grew, Congress allowed for the city to have some level of self-governance, but ultimately, it is the only city that Congress controls the ultimate fate of. And I suppose Congress could create a new district, but they would, of course, have to do something about the current district. And I'm sure, DC would have to be return its land to Maryland. Actually, most of the land, I believe, in Virginia has already been returned to Virginia since then. But I think there are still some sections that are still in Virginia. So I assume Congress could get new land or return the rest and set up a new city. But obviously, that would be a huge debate and take years to figure out, and probably wouldn't even be worth it in the end. Now, as I said, the Constitution does not explicitly give the federal government the authority to create or disincorporate cities. And it doesn't explicitly forbid the states from doing those things individually. Because of this, and the 10th Amendment clearly stating that, quote, the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. This meant that the predominant legal interpretation after the Constitution was ratified has been that every state has the power to set its own standard for municipal incorporation. And this has been reinforced by several legal cases. I think the only situations where this would not be the case would be when the federal government controls a territory that has not been organized and recognized as a state. In those situations, I'm sure Congress wrote laws and rules to govern, those territories. As such, they may have allowed themselves the power to create or recognize cities in those areas, until statehood's established or, just allowed the populations living there to organize, settlements organically. But I don't know which situations happen more frequently. That is research for future Preston to have to dive into. As for my home state, we do have I guess a process by which a city is founded. We have, I believe it is, you have to have, in the area seeking to be incorporated, it has to have a population density of at least 300 people per square mile, I guess, of the area that wants to be incorporated according to the last census. And it cannot be, none of that area can be within 5 miles of the boundary of an active incorporated municipality. And that all land being incorporated is made up of a contiguous adjacent properties. You can't just have, a checkerboard town. It has to be one continuous connection. Now, that's a gross simplification. Obviously, that's the primary step. But then, of course, you have to get, I think it's, I think it's 15% of the people living in that district who signed a petition saying they want to incorporate. You then have to set up a kind of a management plan on what your process is going to be to establish your town. You have to give the Secretary of State very detailed plans, and the Secretary of State can request a number of plans about a number of different things from, I guess, whoever is organizing said effort. And you have to provide it in triplicate. That's explicitly in the law. And then the Secretary of State will present this information to a committee in the state legislature, who will then vote, if this can be added to a ballot. And the Secretary of State, of course, will have to sign off on everything. And then, of course, during an election period, the proposal to incorporate as a state will be put on the ballot to people living in the bounds of the city that, of course, are residents in this proposed area. And, of course, they have to vote, and they have to, of course, get a simple majority. I will say, interestingly enough, the law does not say that the plan has to be viable. Technically speaking, I guess the Secretary of State could just say, yeah, sure, you want to incorporate it, go ahead. But obviously that's not something that you would hope an elected official would do. And there are also some weird ways around the 5-mile rule, but it's very complicated. And I am simplifying things a little bit, but by and large, that's the process in the round for incorporation in my state. That's the answer to that question. I hope you found that interesting. I appreciate both amounts of feedback I got. So let's go ahead and dive on into the primary discussion points for tonight's or today's episode. And to that end, we are going to be talking about a more classical interpretation of cities and their origins, and ones that are a little bit closer to the establishment of the earliest cities than V. Gordon Child was. Now, one view is that of the ancient Greek philosopher Aristoteles, or as we know him in English, Aristotle. Now, I do plan on covering famous philosophers, thinkers, etc., and their works as they enter the historical records and narratives. But for now, I'll give a little information on Aristotle and a brief summary of parts of one of his works that is a very important historical interpretation on the formation of cities. It's very important to the topic this week, so I'm going to get out of order a little bit here. I'll also critique some of what Aristotle says, similar to how we discussed Child's theory last time. Before that, though, I think I do want to mention Plato and his Republic. Plato, whose birth name was actually Aristocles, which is a combination of the ancient Greek aristos, which meant best or optimal, and kleos, which could mean glory or reputation. So Aristocles is probably best translated as the best reputation. Now, Plato, which was probably pronounced more like Platon, derived from platis, which meant broad or wide. A lot of later biographers said that he got the name because of his broad, strong soldiers. So make of that what you will. Now, it's been a while since I've read Plato, but I've never read all of his surviving works. And the ones I've read around, I think, 11 or 12 of his dialogues that I've read fully. But it's been a couple of years since the most recent one. But as far as I know and remember, Plato doesn't talk about the history or supposed history of cities, civilizations in any great detail in any of his works. And that's not surprising. Most of, if not all of, Plato's surviving work is dialogues, and these tend to be more focused on esoteric and theoretical matters rather than practical concerns. Well, that's not true. Not practical concerns, but obviously the concerns he's talking about are very practical, but the way he goes about discussing them and some of his answers to these concerns are far from practical. I'm kind of diving a little too much in there. But yeah, so that's one of the things with Plato that we're going to discuss when we get to the Greek philosophers. However, all that being said, in his Republic, there are some very brief lines where he has Socrates mention why men formed cities and civilizations. And his argument was essentially that man is beholden to needs like food, water, shelter, etc. And that it's very hard and impossible for a man to meet these needs consistently by himself. So he works with others to meet these needs as efficiently as possible. And because some people are better at performing some task rather than others, this gives rise to different trades and people beginning to establish different lifestyles based on what they're good at, and then these people still wanting to be efficient and work together to, provide or, have the easiest life possible. This led to the formations of towns and cities, and then, of course, eventually states. So Plato, through Socrates, is making the argument that a city was ultimately, at its core, a place where man survives with as little effort as possible. Now, of course, the dialogue continues and begins to theorize on hypothetical types of ideal cities and societies that were more and more utopian, among other topics brought up in the Republic. But we will, again, have a more in-depth episode on this dialogue in the future. But that being said, I do find, of course, today, we would not consider necessarily that a city is more efficient or that it is necessarily the place to live with as little effort as possible. I think these days, most people, at least in the Americas, would consider, living in the country with a quiet, boring life to be more easier than living in a city which is more hectic, crime-ridden, pollution-ridden, all that kind of stuff. So this is a very vastly different idea from what Plato is putting forward, at least, or what Socrates is putting forward as the origin of cities. Now, of course, even today, people who are not necessarily a fan of cities understand that, cities have other types of allures, not necessarily ease of life, but necessarily, but maybe more of a more exciting life or a more maybe fulfilling life, if that's your type of thing, if you're equate your fulfillment with your fulfilling excitement or things like that, what have you. But compared that to what Child talks about, obviously the specialization lines up Child's theory of this emergence of specialization or specialized work forces lines up with Plato. And, of course, the need for food and cities being effective at producing food, that lines up pretty well. But those two points are primarily it. The other 8 points are not really brought up by Plato. He does not seem to pay them any... obviously, he's not responding to Child. Child is, you know, millennia after him. But these things that Child brought up as being important to cities did not even play into Socrates' discussion on the origin of cities. To Plato, or through Socrates at least, cities formed for efficiency of, you know, food and supplies, and that is it. That is why cities formed. He doesn't even really go too much into population density. To him, a city could be nice and compact and densely populated, or it could be, you know, fairly widespread. We don't know specifically which he would have preferred for a community like that to be defined as. He may not have even essentially cared. But it's hard to know for sure because, again, this is a very small part at the very beginning of the Republic. It's not meant as a historical, you know, reference point. At least, you know, not that is not the primary push of the Republic. But that does lead me into Plato's student, Aristotle, and what he has to say on the matter in his Politics. Now, Aristotle's name is a combination of, again, the Greek Aristos, which again, can mean best or optimal, and telos, which can mean outcome, purpose, ending. So probably the best way to translate his name could be interpreted as the best outcome. Maybe his family really wanted a boy. Who knows? Now, Aristotle's works, as we know them, were probably never intended for publication. Possibly some were, some weren't. It could be that they were his lecture notes. It's very debated. At the least, though, he probably expected his students would refer to or study them. And some of the topics were probably a little too esoteric for most people of that period to really have the time to dive into and study them. Aristotle, definitely like Plato, enjoyed his esotericism. He loved theoretical stuff, but he was also, he had much more practical applications for his work, or at least tried to make them practical. As we will discuss when we cover Aristotle, some of his theories do not hold up to scrutiny. But others are much more widely still valued in either scientific or philosophical or historical communities, depending on who's doing the reading. And of course, another problem with his works are there were disputes about the ownership of his corpus and the school after he and his immediate successor died. Then there was a dispute over governorship of the Lyceum, which was the academy he founded, and the works in the library of said Lyceum. So that's part of the reasons that only around a third of Aristotle's works have survived. Now, it is, of course, one of these we will be talking about, at least partially, and that is called his Politics. Now, the history of, or at least Aristotle's understanding of the history of the cities, is one of the primary subjects of the first book of Politics. And the title for Politics is a translation of the Greek politika, which is the name given to it by the people who collated Aristotle's works after his death. I don't think he titled any of his his works, essentially translates to as the things concerning the polis, or the poles. And that, of course, at least in modern understanding, translates, is the word that we say that the Greeks used for city, polis. Now, that is not 100% accurate. Over time, the definition has shifted. I think the modern Greek, they use like pola for city. But the Greeks, the polis was, it was the city itself. It was the surrounding countryside. It was the government, and it was the people all together. I think the actual just the urban environment itself would have been, I believe it's asti is how that pronounced. Their word for country, kora, would have been, you know, the kind of the wild environs, or like the, you know, the agricultural fields, olive tree rows, wineries, things like that. Those would all exist in the kora, and the land that one is from, where they were, you know, native to, would be the patrida, or the native land, for, you know, whatever city you're referring to. And of course, as time has gone on, the polis becomes not the highest part of the government, but merely a smaller subdivision of a government. But to the ancient Greeks and to the Sumerians and Mesopotamians, the city-state itself is the state. It is, they are inseparable. You cannot have one without the other, which is something that modern people definitely can understand. And even, you know, people further back in the past, like Gordon Child, he would have more of our understanding of what, that he would have a more modern understanding of city, as opposed to, you know, what the ancient Greeks and Mesopotamians would think about a city. Now, in book one of Politics, Aristotle talks about cities, I think sometimes he uses the term political community. And he talks about them in comparison with smaller communities, or, you know, partnerships between individuals. He talks about the household, the oikos, which is, you know, a father of a family, of an extended family, and his subordinate children, brothers, that kind of thing. He also talks about the relationship between a master and his slave. And he also refers to villages as well. All of this is broken down, and he's very much talking about, you know, how each of these functions in and of themselves, and what's different between them and each other. But he believes the city is important because it allows man to live a more noble life, essentially. Rather than, you know, living on your own out in the country, kind of sequestered away from more people than, you know, if, say, if you were living in the heart of a vibrant metropolis. This is a quote, "Man is by nature a political animal," comes from this part of Politics. And he talks about man's relationship between the city and himself, and then, you know, what the part the household plays in both the life of man and the life of the city. He also pushes back on the idea that, you know, rule by a king is the same as rule of a man over his household, or a man over his slaves. It's not just a difference of size. He very much pushes back on that. And it, you know, it makes you think, you know, how widespread was this enough for him to really call it out? Another thing that Aristotle does that I think would, you know, push back on, you know, a lot of people then, and probably a lot of people now, they would be stunned by his explanation, that the state, and, you know, by extension, the city, are themselves a natural state for man to live in. They are creations of nature. He also goes into how cities formed historically and why cities all started out with kings. He makes the argument, despite earlier claiming that, you know, kingly rule is not just a to scale version of ruling the household, but he argued that the earliest cities were comprised of people who were all in some way related to one another, and that the appointment of a king from among them made, you know, complete sense because everyone was related. You know, it's generally, at least in the earlier Greek periods, the archaic periods, and into the classical era too, it was not necessarily son succeeding father. It was sometimes the oldest member of a particular family who would assume the kingship, the oldest, most fit. So, you know, again, he does say that, you know, being a king is a lot different than just being the father of a household. But he would argue that, you know, a good king would make a good father, in theory at least, like the best king would. But obviously his responsibilities and his duties are very much expanded from just a being a good, wise father of a household or a master of a house. So, you know, that is a distinction that he does kind of try to, you know, thread the needle. And I think he does fair enough. Now, this goes against Child's interpretation of cities as being places where, you know, different lineages of people not related to one another are congregating in large numbers. Now, Aristotle does say that this happens, but he says that this happens later, after, you know, kings had been established and ruled for however long they may have ruled. He said that's what gives rise to the different types of, or what makes kingly rule less acceptable, when there's less of a blood tie to, between members of a, you know, community or people living in the same polis or cora or patria. So, Aristotle would not say that, you know, it's necessary for a city to have a different ethnic makeup, I guess, for lack of a better term. To him, the first cities were entirely, I guess, clan-based or tribal-based, depending on which terminology you want to use. He does agree, or at least seems to agree, with what Socrates, or what Plato has Socrates say, that the state forms as a means of, you know, living, you know, essentially as a means of survival. But he goes further and says that the state continues to exist so that life cannot just be secure, but to be good or better than, you know, what it would be without it. And indeed, he says that, you know, that all, you know, associations like that, the household, the partnership, the village, all of them serve to, you know, push that forward, you know, to make life better for all the people involved. That is the ultimate end, is, you know, this kind of pseudo perfection slash sufficiency. And that's sufficiency for the individual and the sufficiency for all the members of said, you know, grouping, either partnership, household, or city or polis, however you want to discuss it. But again, interestingly, size in both terms of density and of the country and of the population does not play any part whatsoever in Aristotle's definition of a city. It is almost entirely based on economics, efficiency, much like Plato, but he has a political bent to it. Essentially, he's saying that a city, a true city, or polis, in this case a city-state, is not does not exist without a political organization to it. So essentially, no city, no state, no state, no city, which is not something, you know, that Child has. Plato certainly doesn't go that far in his extrapolation, at least in the like actual historical context. There's some, you know, you could debate about the more utopic musings that Socrates puts forward in the Republic, but and also even today, like to us, the state is, you know, very separate from the city. Cities are their own thing. They're places you live. They, of course, have their own governments. They have their own elections, what have you. But the ultimate state is not in any way associated with cities, at least in modern American understanding. They're just they're an outgrowth of the state. In the past, in Aristotle's time, and in the centuries and millennia beforehand, that is absolutely not the case. The city itself is not an outgrowth of the state. It is the state itself. And that's something that, you know, it did not really occur to me until I started researching the topic. And I think, you know, again, Child didn't have that in his points. Of course, he talked about paying taxes. But he, you know, he made it seem that you're paying the taxes to the god or to the king. That was very explicit to him. And then, you know, there were cases where, you know, the king and the god were stand-ins for the city. But even in those cases where you're paying your taxes to that individual or to that deity, the ultimate goal of those taxes is to support the state itself, the apparatus of government. And in some of those cases, the king can't exist without the state or the city, and the city can't exist without the deity or the king, what have you. So Aristotle's definition of a city is efficiency, security, and a government. Whether or not that is confined to a couple of square miles or much larger, he does not seem to differentiate. They are political communities, one and all. They are all polis, and they all have their own quirks and governments and types. And another thing also that Aristotle and probably Plato too would kind of appreciate about Child's definition of a city, though they themselves might disagree with him on a point of it. Child talked about how the science has become formalized. That is something that Plato and Aristotle would probably be, you know, very mindful of, that, you know, that these things flourish in well-governed, well maintained, well-ordered cities or polices. But I don't know that they would say that that necessarily came before them. Plato and Aristotle are Greek chauvinists to a certain extent, though maybe not as much as you might expect. And each of them kind of had different kind of understandings on what it meant to be Greek. But they would have very much, I think, pushed back on the idea that any type of learning came before probably the pre-Socratics, the people who preceded Socrates, who taught, of course, Plato. And then, of course, Aristotle is Plato's student. But I think they would appreciate him trying to, throwing that as part of the definition of a good city, at the very least, if not necessarily part of how cities are run in actuality at that time. Who knows? We've talked about more classical definitions of the city and how they differ very much from what I think a city is and how they're different from child thought they were cities. And how that, to them, a city or a polis or what have you is something that is, not necessarily that difficult to define. It's fairly straightforward what they think a city is. In fact, the city itself may not be complicated. In some cases, their governments might be. But the political communities themselves, it'd be easy to understand, or it's easier to understand who is part of that political community, what is part of that political community, where is part of that political community. And ultimately, a city is a state is a city. At least that's what I get from Aristotle's, talking about a city's emergence, development, foundation. So I think that's a good place to call it for this week. I think one more episode on urbanization. This one will be a little bit straightforward. We're going to talk about the earliest institutions, where these cities are going to be appearing in this season, and what is specifically, what makes them different from cities that may be appearing in other parts of the world, if not this season, next season. Because Mesopotamia has its own process, Egypt has its own process, so, and of course East Asia, India, they all have different kind of paths to urbanization, at least in, when you get into specifics. In general, again, it's concentration of people, it's population density, but when do the states form for those? When do the cities themselves actually become cities, as opposed to some place like Çatalhöyük or Göbekli Tepe, where there is no evidence of a state being supported and supporting its citizens. That's something we'll talk about next time. So thank everyone for joining me this week. I really appreciate the support again. Please, if you have any questions, any feedback, do not hesitate to reach out to me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. Again, you could direct message me on X/Twitter. You can comment on any of the YouTube uploads I do. I live stream on YouTube during the week and sometimes on the weekends. You can drop in chat if I'm live. Ask questions there. I'll be glad to answer. I always like hearing from people. We're over 110 subscribers on YouTube right now. A little bit different audience there than the audio feeds, but appreciate all of you guys the same regardless. So, and again, apologies for last week with the late upload via RSS and the audio issues. It would not lower the volume for the theme song. I lowered it 3 different times. I remixed it and it just got to the point where it was, it was late. I was trying to get it up and out and I uploaded it, but I just didn't schedule it. So, I just pushed it out as soon as I realized, but that will not happen this week. I guarantee it. So I will see everyone next week. Thank you all for listening. If you celebrated Easter, I hope you had a good one, and I hope you have a good rest of your day whenever you hear this. Thank you all. Goodbye.